Good morning, everyone.
Let's start with a short meditation just to relax the body, relax the mind, and set a good motivation for the day. We begin, as always, by preparing the body. Finding a comfortable posture. Back nice and straight. And allow the entire body to become completely relaxed, completely at ease. Using the out-breath to relax and release any tightness or tension in any part of the body. And bringing your awareness to the area of your face, and softening and relaxing all the muscles in the face. Mouth and jaw soft and relaxed. And all the muscles around the eyes soft and relaxed. In this way, allowing the entire body to become completely relaxed, completely at ease. And allowing the breathing to settle into its natural rhythm. Not trying to control or regulate the breath in any way. Simply allowing it to flow naturally and effortlessly. And then preparing the mind, setting it in a state of ease and relaxation. Not dwelling in the past, not anticipating the future. Simply allowing the mind to come to rest in the present moment. through focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. And maintaining an ongoing flow of mindfulness of the sensations of the breath throughout the entire cycle of each in and out breath. If you become distracted, then the first thing to do is simply relax. And then release the distraction and very gently return to focusing on the breath. So relax, release, and return. Each time you notice you've become distracted, keep coming back to the breath. Again and again. And relaxing more deeply with each out-breath. or if you find yourself falling into dullness or simply being spaced out, then use the in-breath as an opportunity to arouse and refresh your focus, to sharpen your focus on the breath. So relaxing and releasing distractions on the out-breath and sharpening the focus on the in-breath. In this way, we can achieve a balanced mind, a relaxed and focused mind. Now we can spend a few moments reflecting on our motivation for coming to here to this course. Then we can spend a few moments setting the best possible motivation we can for attending this course. and then try to extend that motivation out to include others. That we're not just attending this course for our own benefit, but we're attending it so that we can be of more benefit to those around us. And then keeping this motivation in mind, we can slowly end this meditation and begin our discussions together today. So let's start with a short review of some of the points from yesterday afternoon before we go into the text. So we saw that the Buddha, in his teachings, gave these teachings in three sort of what are called the three turnings of the wheel of Dharma. And we saw there that in the first turning of the wheel of Dharma called the Four Noble Truths, he taught that we are stuck in this state of dukkha and that we are stuck in this state because of our mental afflictions, and that if we really want to overcome this mental afflictions and suffering and achieve liberation, achieve this goal of nirvana, then we need to eliminate the fundamental ignorance. And here in the Four Noble Truths, the fundamental ignorance is this grasping onto self, that we overinflate the sense of me, we're grasping onto an autonomous me. And so if we can come to realize there's no autonomous self here, we can eliminate all mental afflictions, suffering, and achieve nirvana. So that's the first turning of the wheel of Dharma called the Four Noble Truths. And this, of course, is the foundation of all Buddhist traditions. And this is the foundation or the core of the what's called now the Theravada traditions. So they are the schools of Buddhism such as in Sri Lanka, Burma, Thailand, Laos, Cambodia, Southeast Asia. And so they have as their core the Four Noble Truths, and they're being spread to those countries through the Pali language. But then we saw that in the second and the third turning of the wheel of Dharma, that in both of these, the Buddha went a bit further and he said that, well, not just how we see ourselves is a problem, but how we see the world is also a problem. The world is not existing as it appears. And we saw there that in the second turning of the wheel of Dharma, what's called without characteristics, that he said that there's actually, even though there seems to be an independent me, an independent world, the person and the world do not exist in this way, that nothing exists independently, the idea of emptiness, that everything's empty of independent existence. And in the third turning of the wheel, called fine discrimination, he said that the world, how the world appears is deceiving us, but actually the world, it appears to be external to us. It appears to be an external material world, but in fact, if we investigate closely, we'll come to realize that it's internal to the mind. So that forms the basis of what's called the Chittamatra philosophical system or mind-only philosophical system. So both the second and third turning of the wheel also talk about achieving the further goal of enlightenment. So those two turnings of the wheel are the basis of what's now called the Mahayana Buddhist tradition. So that includes, of course, Chinese Buddhism, Zen, Korean, Vietnamese, and Tibetan Buddhism. And so this Mahayana vehicle then was transmitted to these countries through the Sanskrit language. And so what we saw there is then we can talk even about three vehicles. Not only can we talk about the Theravada, where the goal is nirvana, And the Mahayana, the goal is enlightenment, but also we can talk about the Vajrayana or Tantra vehicle. So like Mahayana, of course, Vajrayana or Tantra has the goal of enlightenment, and it's the same wisdom that we need to realize, this wisdom of emptiness. But of course, in Vajrayana or Tantra, we're trying to gain access to a much deeper level of our mind, this very subtle level of our mind. And what we saw also briefly in the beginning of the text we're following is that we are all vehicles, directly or indirectly, are coming to the point of overcoming two faults. The two faults that we're overcoming is self-grasping. Self-grasping here, of course, grasping onto independent me, independent world. And then self-cherishing is on the basis of self-grasping, then we grasp onto this me not only as independent, but as the most important. My happiness is more important than the happiness of anyone else. And coming from the Tibetan, self-grasping is using the sort of Wiley spelling, duck zin. Zin means to grasp, and duck is self. So grasping to self. And self-cherishing is dakche zin. So grasping or holding the self as che means dear. So here we're grasping to self, and here we're grasping or holding to self as dear, meaning me, I'm the most important, I'm more important than anyone else. So the antidotes to these two, of course, to overcome self-grasping, we need to develop wisdom. And to overcome self-cherishing is the compassion wing of the practice. So we saw that in both Theravada and Mahayana, we have these two wings of practice, two main wings of practice of wisdom and compassion. And at the Theravada level, foundation level, the wisdom wing is to realize these three marks of existence, in particular, realize there's no autonomous me, no self. And the compassion wing are these four immeasurables, loving kindness, compassion, empathetic joy, equanimity. And in the Mahayana, we build on those two as a foundation. And in the wisdom wing, we come to realize emptiness. And of course, the realization of emptiness is the antidote to self-grasping, because that's a realization. There's no independent me, independent world. And then we build on the four immeasurables with this aspiration of bodhicitta. And that aspiration of bodhicitta, of course, is going to overcome the self-cherishing attitude. So, therefore, directly or indirectly, we are overcoming these two faults. And in the compassion wing here at the Mahayana level, bodhicitta, we saw briefly yesterday there were two main methods taught on how to cultivate this. The first and most common method that was taught in India and Tibet was this seven cause and effect method. And the second method, which was more a secret method, which was only taught to people who could really appreciate it, was called exchanging self with others. And that's the approach we're going to be using in this text here. Is that the two main, because Lojong, or mind training as it's translated here into English, is a system of practice that came from Tibet into from India into Tibet through this great Indian master Lama Atisha. And then that was passed down through the early Tibetan lineage of what's called the Kadampas, through Tromtompa and Potawa and so forth. And in that system of practice, of course, the two core elements of practice is emptiness and bodhicitta. And in the bodhicitta practice, we're using this approach of exchanging self with others. And what we see here in the Lojong approach, mind training, we can talk about actually the two types of bodhicitta, or the two bodhicittas. So another way of talking about these two wings of practice of bodhicitta and emptiness is sometimes, and this is what we see in this text, they're referred to as the two bodhicittas. That's translated here in the text as mind of awakening. Because citta is mind and body is enlightenment, sometimes translated as awakening. So it's the mind of awakening. And the two bodhicittas referred to as conventional and ultimate bodhicitta. And conventional bodhicitta is simply what we normally understand as bodhicitta, is this aspiration for enlightenment so that we can help to liberate everyone else from suffering. And then ultimate bodhicitta is this wisdom of emptiness. So that's how these two wings of practice are described in this text, and often you'll find this way of expressing these two types of bodhicitta, conventional and ultimate. And this mind training system of practice is widely practiced in all the, I think, all the four schools of Tibetan Buddhism. And one of the great advantages of this Lojong or mind training approach to practice is, as we're going to see a little bit later in the third point, is this ability to take adverse conditions into the path. That normally in any lineage of practice, any Buddhist system of practice, we always talk about gathering conducive conditions to have good conditions for practice. But the reality, of course, is that we face many obstacles and difficult situations in our life, and that often blocks us in our ability to practice well. But here in the mind training system, there are instructions on how to even see difficult situations as conducive conditions for practice. And in particular, this approach here of exchanging self with others, it lends itself very well to be able to take these difficult situations into the path. So based on this particular Buddhist approach, but also the idea of emptiness, we have ability to take very difficult situations into the path and see them as conducive conditions for practice. So we can use every situation in our life as a conducive condition for practice. And we're going to see that later in the text. So that's what we sort of covered a little bit yesterday. And so let's go back now to the text. And we can go to page 2 of the commentary. And again, we'll just go through very briefly the 7 points. So remember, this text we're following here is called the 7-point mind training. And this text, together with the 8 verses of mind training, are probably the two most widely taught mind training texts. The 8 verses of mind training is coming from Geshe Langri Tampa, who was part of the early Kadampa lineage. And here, this seven-point mind training is coming from Geshe Chikawa. But remember, Geshe Chikawa is not really the author of these points here, because these points, as we see in the text at the beginning, are a list of 57 very short, pithy slogans or statements. And these are, of course, coming from Atisha, from India into Tibet, particularly through his teacher Tselingpa. So these list of pithy instructions that we're going to be looking at are coming through Lama Atisha. But what Geshe Chikawa did was he systematized those into these seven groupings, these 7 points. And then the commentary we're using is from Tse Chubu Chege Gyaltsen, one of his main disciples, which effectively are just notes that he took from teachings from Geshe Chikawa. So the commentary we're following is really a commentary from Geshe Chikawa himself about these points. And so we see all these 57 slogans are arranged in these 7 points. And so let's just briefly go through them again before we go to the first point. So the first of the 7 is the presentation of the preliminaries, the basis. So, of course, with any spiritual practice, we need to establish a good foundation for the main practices. And so we'll be looking at that now as the very first point. The second of the 7 points is training in the 2 minds of awakening, the main practice. So again, here, the 2 minds of awakening. Mind of awakening is a translation of the word bodhicitta. So we're talking about the main practice is these 2 bodhicittas, the training in conventional bodhicitta and the training in ultimate bodhicitta. And then third point is taking adverse conditions onto the path of enlightenment. So as I just briefly mentioned now, one of the great strengths with the mind training or Lojong approach to practice is the ability to take adverse conditions, difficult situations, and use that as conducive conditions for practice. The fourth of the 7 points, presentation of a lifetime's practice in summary, is the describing the essence of all of these mind training practices. They're sort of condensed into five aspects, 5 things that we really need to do in our daily life to extract the essence of all of this mind training practice. And so we'll look at that, of course. The 5th point is the presentation of the measure of having trained the mind. So with any system of practice, it would be good to have a way of measuring our progress. Are we actually progressing in the practice or not? So here we see some instructions on how to check whether or not our mind training practice is progressing and is heading in the right direction. And then the 6th of the 7 points, presentation of the commitments of mind training, talking about what sorts of things go against mind training. So what would violate the core intentions of mind training practice. So in this 6th point, we'll see a lot of don't do this, don't do this, don't do this, meaning what things to avoid so that we don't go against our mind training practice. Whereas the 7th point, the presentation of the precepts of mind training, are things that we are to engage in to help support and nurture the practice of mind training. So these are the 7 points that we'll be going through. So let's go to the 1st point. But before I do, is there any questions of anything we've covered yesterday and so far? Anything not clear?
It is recognized in Buddhism, like you say, there is no independent, autonomous self. Then who is...
Very good question, and we're going to be answering that in the 2nd of the 7 points. So the short answer, of course, is no Buddhist tradition says there's no me. All Buddhist traditions are simply trying to answer the question, how do I exist? Not whether or not I exist, because if we don't exist, we can't even question that. So, of course, the fact that we're able to question it means we exist. So what we're going to look at is how do we exist? And we saw yesterday briefly in these four philosophical systems that came out of the various teachings of the Buddha, Vaibhashika, Sautrantika, Chittamatra, and Majjhimika, generally they come up with some slightly different assertions about how I exist and how the world exists. And we're going to look in detail in here, in the mind training, particularly at the Majjhimika philosophical system. What do they say about how do I exist, how the world exists? Who is the me that meditates and achieves enlightenment? So that's what we're going to answer in the second of the 7 points. So it's coming up. Don't worry.
I still don't get the idea of Vipassana. Is it Vipassana?
So Vipassana, remember, the word Vipassana.
Yeah, it's like inside.
Yeah.
But then, like.
So Vipassana again, or Vipassana, just means insight. And so we're talking about insight into reality. But then you say, well, what do you mean by insight into reality? In the Theravada tradition, when they talk about insight, they talk about gaining three insights. First, we gain an insight into impermanence, the fact that everything's changing moment by moment. Why is that useful? It's useful because, and of course, we all intellectually accept impermanence now because science has proven it. We learned it at school. But I think none of us have any argument about whether or not things are changing moment by moment. We know that. Science has proven it. But is our intellectual understanding of impermanence, is that helping us in our daily life in any way? Not really. Because our behavior is not driven by our intellectual understanding. It's driven by our instinctive habit. And our instinctive habit is telling us this bowl is more or less the same bowl that was here yesterday and it'll be more or less the same bowl here tomorrow. And that's how we relate to the bowl. That's how we relate to everything in the world. And, of course, that way of relating to things is completely out of sync with reality. This bowl is changing moment by moment. But because we're relating to it as if it's not, then we end up with a lot of problems and suffering. Because when things do change, we get frustrated, we get upset, we get disappointed. So if we can bring our intellectual understanding of impermanence into experience through Vipassana practice, what you're going to notice immediately is your craving and attachment for pleasant things, your aversion to unpleasant things will dramatically decrease, dramatically. Because if we're experientially seeing things as changing moment by moment, then there's nothing to grab. There's nothing for attachment to grab hold of. There's nothing for aversion to push against. So even this insight into impermanence, if we can internalize this, it would already have a dramatic improvement in our quality of our life. Much less craving and attachment, much less aversion, much less suffering. So that's the first one. And then the second one was the insight into dukkha, which we looked at briefly yesterday, the first noble truth, and we're going to look at that in more detail this morning again, is if we can internalize that, and again, intellectually, we may look at that dukkha that we looked at and we go, yeah, I accept that. But again, we haven't experienced it. If we can bring that inside in our Vipassana practice, if we can come to experientially see the very nature of our existence, the human existence, then we're going to stop looking for happiness out there and we're going to turn our attention inwards. We're going to be able to develop the aspiration for liberation and instead of chasing after sense pleasures. So that's going to have a dramatic improvement in our life. But then, of course, if we can come to realize in our Vipassana practice there's no autonomous me here, then the assertion in the Theravada is if we can come to realize that, we can achieve liberation from samsara, we can achieve nirvana. And then, of course, in the Mahayana, if in our Vipassana practice we can come to realize emptiness, there's no independent me, no independent world, then on the basis of the bodhicitta motivation, we can even achieve the further goal of enlightenment. So Vipassana, insight practice, is gaining these insights for these reasons. Does that help?
Are you saying it's like all meditation is through the practice?
No. So, and we're going to see shortly that, and we saw yesterday the three core practices in all Buddhist traditions: ethics, concentration, wisdom. So ethics is the basis, ethical lifestyle. On that basis, we have to develop concentration, shamatha practice, or in the Theravada, it's often called jhana practice. Theravada usually don't use the word shamatha, they talk about jhana, but it's concentration practice. Because without shamatha practice or concentration practice, if we don't develop a calm, clear, focused mind, Vipassana practice is not going to do anything for us, because we're going to sit down and meditate on what any of these insights, and we're going to try and meditate, and then we're going to get distracted, get half asleep, we're going to be all over the place. So nothing's going to go inside. So unless we put effort into the concentration practice, the shamatha practice, and really develop a very calm, clear, focused mind, Vipassana practice, you can do a lot of Vipassana practice and have no impact or very little impact. But then if we do put effort into the shamatha practice and we develop a more calm, clear, focused mind, and then we engage in Vipassana practice to gain insight, then it can really make a lot of progress. But as I said yesterday, that we have these two wings of practice and we need to balance. So not only do we need to engage in Vipassana practice, we need to engage in the compassion wing of practice. Because if we don't work on these meditations, there's a danger that this Vipassana practice could turn into simply becoming very self-absorbed and very disconnected from the world. So what we can see then in terms of meditation practice, we can talk about sort of three core areas of meditation practice. The foundation is shamatha, calm, clear, focused mind. On that basis, to engage in Vipassana practice or wisdom practice and balance that with the compassion wing of practice, loving kindness, compassion, empathetic joy, equanimity. And of course, here we're talking about cultivating bodhicitta. So sometimes these three types of meditation are likened to three legs of a tripod. If a tripod is going to stand up, we need all three legs. If one of them is missing, it's falling over. Meaning if we don't do shamatha practice, compassion and wisdom won't get very far. If we do just shamatha without that, it'll fall down. If we just do shamatha and vipassana without compassion, it'll fall down. If we do shamatha with compassion with no wisdom, it'll fall down. It won't be effective. We need three, those three. Shamatha, and then on that basis, compassion and wisdom. Does that help?
What about analytical meditation?
So both the compassion and the vipassana are analytical. So shamatha is what's called stabilizing meditation. So that's to stabilize the mind. And on the basis of a stable, clear mind, we do analytical meditation. And analytical meditation is all of this is analytical because we're investigating. In shamatha, we're not investigating, we're just focusing. So therefore, we can talk about two types of meditation, stabilizing and analytical. And analytical can be vipassana, gaining insight. Analytical can be this wing of practice where we investigate and then come to cultivate compassion, loving kindness, and bodhicitta through that investigation.
Yeah, maybe it's just I have difficulty with the word.
Which word? Vipassana? What do you mean? What difficulty?
I don't know.
Yeah. Remember, it's just gaining insight. It's to come to see the nature of reality. That's it.
Maybe because, like, in the introduction course, when I do meditation, like, they don't really use the word, just like...
I use it all the time in my introduction course.
You use it, but at least, like, in Robina's course and Kira, they don't really use it. They just speak, like, shamatha. They don't even use the word shamatha. Maybe I don't know. So it's like... Maybe we're doing this, but not without people realizing.
Like I said yesterday, I like to go back a lot to the Sanskrit word because then there's no confusion because it's clear what that is. Whereas often the various English words that are used, different translators use different English words, and then it's not obvious that one person is using this word, another person is using this. Actually, they're talking about the same thing. It's not obvious to us. So therefore, if we go back to the Sanskrit, then we have no difficulty. Okay. Yeah.
You are referring to mindfulness. So where exactly do you put it? Because I always remember, you know, the story about the monk that was sitting in the mountain. He was, like, you know, meditation like this, and then his helper, she was more she had more insight from him, and she wasn't doing the meditation. She was working, but she was practicing mindfulness. So if you're talking about mindfulness, where exactly do you like?
Yeah. So mindfulness is a mental factor that we need to develop. And that's the main mental factor that we're developing in the shamatha practice. So in shamatha, we are strengthening the muscle of mindfulness. It's like going to the gym, shamatha practice. So shamatha practice is about strengthening mindfulness by continually focusing on a single object and coming back whenever you get distracted. So we're strengthening or cultivating mindfulness in shamatha. And then, on that basis, we apply mindfulness in all the other meditations. In fact, in the Vipassana, in the Theravada, they often talk about the four applications of mindfulness, meaning they're applying the mindfulness that we develop in shamatha to gain insight. And, of course, we apply mindfulness in our bodhicitta meditation to cultivate bodhicitta. So mindfulness is being applied in the analytical meditations and it's being cultivated in the shamatha practice.
The thing is, you know, sometimes I feel that I have more understanding of impermanence when I'm practicing pain, you know, in my work or in daily life, not necessarily doing meditation.
Exactly. And so practice, in whatever we do, any practice always has two parts: meditation and daily life integration. If we don't do both of these together, we're not going to get very far in impermanence or anything. Because if we only sit down and meditate a little bit on impermanence in the morning and get a little taste of it, but then we run around and in our day without continuing to work on that in daily life, then whatever we do in daily life will work against that. But if we don't meditate, you'll find that trying to just bring it into daily life is difficult because we have such a strong habit, the opposite. So if we meditate, internalize, we've started something and then we can continue to work on that for the rest of the day and then that'll feed back in. So if we do those two things for every practice, for impermanence, for emptiness, loving kindness, compassion, then we can make some progress. So therefore, both are important.
Just one question, because English is not my first language. Is there a difference between awareness and mindfulness, or is it like a synonym?
The word awareness we have to be very careful with. It's a very popular word, and unfortunately different translators use it to translate very different Sanskrit terms. And so it's a minefield. Whenever I hear the word awareness, I sometimes cringe. Because I think, well, what is this person using? What are they translating as awareness here? Just for a couple of examples. Sometimes, if we speak very generally, sometimes the word awareness is synonymous with mind and consciousness. Synonymous. Sometimes. Sometimes translators use the word awareness only for the very subtle mind. Sometimes other translators use the word awareness to translate this idea of introspection, you know, when we have to monitor, you know, when we're doing shamatha, we have to notice if we become dull or distracted. And that mental factor that does that is often it's called introspection. Sometimes translators translate that as awareness. And then sometimes the function of the mind is translated as awareness. So it's a complete minefield. The word awareness. So when you hear it, we have to then try and understand, well, how is this translator or this person using this word? It's very confusing.
Yeah.
Very confusing. Sometimes, due to the context, you can sort of understand how the word is being used. For example, generally, most often, when we, in the Kagyu and Nyingma school, when they use the word awareness, they usually, not always, but often it only means very subtle mind, only. In fact, in Nyingma, they tend to stick with the Tibetan word rikpa, which is awareness, translated as awareness. So there, usually in the Kagyu Nyingma, if you see the word awareness, again, not always, because even there some translators use that word to mean other things, but most commonly in the Kagyu Nyingma, when you see the word awareness, it only means the very subtle mind. But again, even there, there's translators use it to mean different things. So it's really very confusing. I find it very confusing because it's a very popular word. And so we have to do a bit of digging when we see that word. How is this translator using this word awareness? Because otherwise we're just going to get completely confused. Okay. Let's go to the first of the 7 points. So it says here, presentation of preliminary practices, the basis. And here we have the first of the 57 slogans here. The first one is, first train in the preliminaries. And to introduce this point, I'd like to read a little bit from this book here, The Practice of Lojong from Chalak Gyapgon. So this is one of the two modern-day commentaries I'm going to use just to give us a little bit of balance, because remember, this commentary here that we're following was written in the 11th century. So if we're going to use two commentaries a little bit from time to time. This one from Chalak Gyapgon, he's a modern-day Kagyu master. And then I'm going to also use the Buddhism with an Attitude from Alan Wallace, and he's coming from the Nyingma tradition of Tibetan Buddhism, also a modern-day practitioner and scholar. So here on page 15, he says the following about this point one, the preliminaries. The preliminaries are the basis upon which we build our practice. Their contemplation lends a sense of urgency to our spiritual endeavors and serves as an antidote to the negative tendencies that frustrate our goals. They remind us of what is really important in life and inspire us to use our time constructively instead of squandering it on meaningless and superficial activities. Time passes very quickly, and unless we recognize the urgency of our situation by thoroughly and unflinchingly reflecting on these preliminary reminders, we will dissipate our opportunities and forfeit the things that are of real benefit to us. If our spiritual practice doesn't have a strong foundation, we will never have what it takes to persevere. Myriad distractions, such as worrying about defaulting on our mortgage or paying our insurance, or scheming about how to get the boss's job, will diminish our intelligence and obscure our spiritual aspirations. Lazy and complacent, we will crawl out of bed and drift without purpose through the emotions of our day. According to the Lojong texts, the antidote to this worldly malaise is to contemplate the preliminaries at the beginning of each practice session, an act that will not only sharpen our intelligence, but will renew our enthusiasm for the spiritual path. And we're going to see how we can introduce these preliminaries at the beginning of each practice a little bit later this morning. But first we'll have a look at the commentary here, bottom of page 2 on the right-hand side. The practice of this mind training, the practitioner of this mind training, must be someone who, by relying on a qualified teacher whose lineage stems from a teacher, has trained his or her mind in the three scopes in a systematic order and has reached a certain level. The practitioner, having generated the two awakening minds, aspiring and engaging, is cognizant of including even the minute precepts of these practices. These are the prerequisites. So here, of course, we're talking about this mind training is coming through this lineage from Atisha, from India into Tibet. And Atisha, remember, not only brought in the Lojong system of practice, but he brought the practice system of practice in Tibet called Lam Rim, stages of the path to enlightenment. And that's what's being referred to here, is that these three scopes are how to systematically develop a good foundation based on the Lam Rim structure. So that's what I'd like to briefly look at now, is have a look at how we can develop or cultivate these preliminaries in a step-by-step way, as they're outlined here in the Lam Rim. And then we'll look at, on that basis, then we'll look at how the same preliminaries are presented in the Kagyu school of Tibetan Buddhism. So here he's talking about that we have to go through these three scopes in a systematic order to really develop or cultivate these preliminaries for mind training practice. And so in the Lam Rim, the first topic you see is relying on a teacher, as sort of mentioned here, is that by relying on a qualified teacher whose lineage stems from a teacher. So, of course, here, if we're going to follow the mind training approach to practice, then, of course, it would be very helpful to be able to rely on a teacher who is coming from that lineage, who themselves are practicing mind training, so that we can get instructions and ask questions. Then, following this in the Lam Rim, there is a topic, the next topic is precious human life. To reflect on the fact that we've got this precious human life. To really understand that, because generally in our life, we don't tend to appreciate things until we've either lost them or about to lose them. And the simile goes with our life. Often we don't appreciate this precious life we have until we've lost it or about to lose it. Often it's only very much later in our life, as we're approaching death, do we realize how precious life we had, and then we're full of regrets at having wasted our life. So this reflection on precious human life is to help us to appreciate the wonderful opportunity we have now, the precious life we have, and to make use of it while we still have it, and not to waste our life and then later be full of regrets. And then how to make our life meaningful is, in the Lam Rim, presented in terms of these three scopes, or three levels of capacity. How can we make our life meaningful? So at the foundation level, or the initial level, so this is the one of the first scope or initial capacity, is that we would simply want to strive for a good future. And to help us to strive for a good future, the first topic that is presented here in the Lam Rim is to reflect on death and impermanence. Because
Because even though we may appreciate that we've got a precious human life and we want to make use of it, often we still sort of have this idea, oh yeah, I'm going to make my life meaningful, but now I'm busy. You know, I have to do my career thing now and family commitments and all that. So I'll do that spiritual stuff later, you know, when I'm retired or sometime later. And we keep putting it off and off and off and we never begin. Reflecting on death and impermanence will help avoid that, that we don't know how long we'll have this precious life. So let's make use of it now before it's too late. And then on that basis of reflecting on death and impermanence, then in the Lam Rim, there's a topic. Of refuge, you know, who or what can we turn to for refuge so that we can strive for a good future? And so here the topic of refuge is the idea of the three jewels, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, that we can really rely on the Buddha's teachings to help us to strive for the good future. And in particular, what teaching can be very helpful for us to strive for a good future is to reflect on karma. Because by reflecting on karma, we can understand that if we engage in harmful behavior, we'll end up with suffering. If we engage in virtuous behavior, we'll end up with happiness experiences. So then by reflecting on karma, then that'll help us to become ethical. So then therefore we can really strive for a good future. And so that's the minimum way we can make our life meaningful, is simply adopting an ethical lifestyle. And I think the basis of any meaningful life is ethical lifestyle. But of course, here we can understand that, you know, if we have an ethical lifestyle, very good, we'll reduce our suffering and have a better future. But still, we're going to be stuck in samsara. We're still going to be cycling a life after life in this condition. Okay, conditions are not too bad, but we're still stuck. So at the next level or scope or capacity, we can go to the next level, not only looking for a good future, but looking to break free altogether. So at the next level, we can strive to break free of samsara altogether and achieve liberation from suffering, achieve the goal of nirvana. But of course, even to begin to do that, we need to understand the situation we're in. And so we need to reflect on the first noble truth of dukkha. And also reflect on the second noble truth. Why are we stuck in this state? And if we can reflect and realize this, then we're going to develop this aspiration of wishing to break free, that knowing that we can get out of samsara by eliminating ignorance and mental afflictions. And so that's going to help us to strive for the goal of nirvana. And then, of course, to actually achieve nirvana, we need the three core trainings: ethics, concentration, wisdom. So here, then, the three higher trainings. But then, of course, you know, we can practice the three higher trainings, particularly here, the wisdom, vipassana practice, to realize no self and achieve nirvana. But then we can understand, well, we're not the only ones stuck in this mess. Everyone else is. So we can make our life meaningful at the next level, the highest level, and that's someone of great scope or great capacity, where we understand that we're not only going to liberate ourselves from suffering, but to strive for the goal of enlightenment so that we can help to liberate everyone else from suffering. And so, again, if we want to even begin to do this, we have to develop the aspiration of bodhicitta. So here in the Lam Rim are the two topics of how to cultivate the bodhicitta, which is the seven cause and effect and the exchanging self with others. And then, of course, once we cultivate bodhicitta through one of these methods, then we need to strive for enlightenment. And as we saw in the Three Vehicles chart, the practices were the six perfections. We practice the six perfections. And, of course, one of those six perfections, the vipassana, the wisdom practice, is the wisdom of emptiness. So if we want to practice this wisdom of emptiness and this exchanging self with others, which are the two core practices of mind training, we need to have the basis. We need to do all of this as a preliminaries. So that's what's being mentioned here. That what are the preliminaries for mind training, for the exchanging self with others, and the wisdom practice here in the six perfections is all of this. This is the preliminaries. This is the foundation. In the Kagyu school, when they talk about preliminaries, they package it a little bit different than this. And they talk about the four thoughts. The four thoughts that turn the mind. The four thoughts that turn the mind towards spiritual practice. Or in other words, the four thoughts that turn the mind towards a more meaningful life. So what are the four thoughts? Exactly the same as in the Lam Rim. The first one is precious human life. The second is death and impermanence. The third is karma. And the fourth is to reflect on dukkha. So we see the same core preliminary practices. And so that's what we're going to be looking at now in the next session this morning, is we're going to look at these preliminary practices in terms of these four thoughts. Precious human life. Reflecting on death and impermanence. Karma. And dukkha. That these are the core preliminary practices here for mind training. So that's the overview. Any questions on that? And then we'll take a morning tea break.
So the second point, the three hybrid training.
Yeah. So here at this second level of making our life meaningful, we are striving to break free of suffering altogether, to achieve nirvana. To even begin to have that aspiration, we need to reflect on dukkha and its causes, first two noble truths, to understand the situation we're in, and that we're stuck here because of our mental afflictions and ignorance, and that we can eliminate the mental afflictions and ignorance. And so by reflecting on these two, we'll develop the aspiration to break free. This, what's normally translated as renunciation, but not a very good translation. So this is going to be, reflecting on those will lead us to develop the aspiration for liberation, for nirvana, renunciation. Then we have the aspiration for nirvana, but then how do we achieve nirvana? How do we get to nirvana? Is the three higher trainings. Remember in the Theravada, the three higher trainings, if we expand that, it's the Noble Eightfold Path. But if we condense the Noble Eightfold Path, we have the three higher trainings: ethics, concentration, wisdom. So this is, any of you who've done a Goenka Vipassana retreat, of course, coming from this level of practice, that's what Goenkaji talks about all the time. Shila Samadhi Panya, Shila Samadhi Panya. So these are the three core practices to engage in to achieve nirvana. Any other questions about the preliminaries? So this is just the overview, and we're going to look at each one of these in detail now in the next session.
What is the seven before the cause and effect?
Seven cause and effect, okay. So this is something I'm going to talk about later when we get to that point. There were, remember this, in India and Tibet, two main approaches to developing bodhicitta, to cultivate bodhicitta. The most common technique that was taught was the seven cause and effect, which has seven steps you go through. And the one we're looking at in the mind training is the second technique, this exchanging self with others, which we can talk about five steps. And so we'll look at that in detail, but I'll briefly mention this also a little bit later. But the first of these seven steps is simply to see everyone as our mother, and then remembering their kindness and wish to repay their kindness and so on. And we'll go through those steps a little bit later. But the technique, so even though this is the main technique that was taught on how to cultivate and develop bodhicitta, in mind training we use this approach, which personally I think is a more powerful approach for us in our modern society. Maybe, I think for many of us it works better as well.
Stages of the path, it sounds like a kind of staircase.
Staircase. Yeah, well, here we're talking about stages as in this is sort of levels.
Yeah, or levels. But I get the feeling that we are working on all levels at the same time. I mean, at the beginning I thought I had to complete the level, like in computer games. And then
good question. I like to use the analogy of building a three-story house. If you're building a three-story house, do you have to finish the first floor 100% before you begin the second floor?
Not in India.
No, but anywhere, in any country. Yeah. You don't, do you? The first floor has to have a minimum structure. Otherwise, you begin the second floor, it just collapses. Yeah. But you don't have to finish the 100%. So you do the first floor to a certain level, strong, then you start the second, and while you're working the second, you keep working on the first to make it complete. And then the second one you have to have at a certain level to even begin the third. And then once you start the third, you're still working on the second and probably still working on the first. So, like that. Nine-round breathing exercise. Nine-round breathing exercise we can do at a number of levels. When we do that in Tantra or Vajrayana practice, it's a very subtle practice, and it's to do with balancing subtle energies. But at our level, the nine-round breathing exercise, and we're going to actually talk about that and something related this afternoon, is simply to prepare the mind at the beginning of a meditation session. How to prepare the mind, why we do that, I'm going to talk about this afternoon. But at our level, the nine-round breathing exercise is something we can do at the beginning of every meditation session, if we find it useful, as a way of preparing the mind. What effect that has on preparing the mind, we'll look at this afternoon. Nine-round breathing exercise, no. No. I'll explain more this afternoon. Okay. Okay, it's time for a morning tea break. So let's take a half an hour break. Come back at 10:45. There's no gong next session, so you have to keep an eye on the time, and we'll start at 10:45.